Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated February 1st. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's story, top of the fold, fares rising, eroding RDU's cost edge. This article is from Chris Bagley and is from Morrisville. Airfares have been rising steadily for the past 3 years, particularly at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, a historically inexpensive location that is losing some of its advantage. The average fare at RDU was $200.52 in the third quarter of 2012 after taxes and fees, up 22% from the fourth quarter of 2009, according to U.S. Department of Transportation data, analyzed by the consulting firm Boyd Aviation. The average fare nationally rose by 18% to $208.07 during the same period. Analysts say airlines have begun taking a magnifying glass to spoke routes, which they had traditionally used to feed their more profitable routes between hubs, particularly international routes. The airfares out of the smaller communities like Raleigh-Durham are going to be higher than the airfares out of the airports where the airlines have their hub operations. So says Bob Herbst, a consultant who runs AirlineFinancials.com. Airlines have been able to raise fares by reducing the frequency of flights and by replacing relatively large airliners with smaller aircraft. Airlines had an average of 191 daily departures last year at RDU, down from 197 in 2011. Load factors are at an all-time record high, says Herbst, using an industry term that measures how full airplanes are. Average load factor rose to 80.2% from 78.8% at RDU last year. While standard fares have increased only marginally, people in the industry say promotions and last-minute discounts have become much more rare than they were a couple of years ago. Meanwhile, several airlines have added new routes that allow RDU passengers to bypass hubs in the middle of the country, such as United Airlines' new nonstop flight to San Francisco. Delta Airlines and American Airlines are preparing to launch nonstops to Los Angeles. And RDU remains less expensive than most of its peers in the Southeast and nationwide. Echoing independent analyst, Airport Director Michael Langeth attributes that to RDU's diversity of carriers. Airlines have greater pricing power at airports such as Charlotte, which is dominated by a U.S. Airways hub. Passengers flying to and from the Triangle paid about 18 cents per mile in the third quarter of 2012, compared to 20 cents a mile at Nashville's airport, 22 cents a mile in Charlotte, and 24 cents a mile in Columbia, South Carolina. But the gap has narrowed considerably since late 2009. Total average fares rose more quickly at RDU than those three airports over the last 3 years. The airlines have also gotten the tailwind from a modest economic recovery both in their RDU routes and elsewhere. Passenger traffic at RDU rose about 1% last year, even as airlines cut capacity and raised airfares. Maupin Travel, an agency with three offices in the Triangle, had one of its best years ever last year, says Vice President Al Baldy. Corporate accounts, which make up about three-quarters of the company's business, have remained strong because companies simply have to fly their employees out to see customers and to visit other offices, Baldy says. And leisure travel is similar, he says. There seems to be so much pent-up demand. People are tired of being stuck at home. And now, NCSU proving more adept at cutting costs than UNC Chapel Hill, by Jason DeBrun, from Chapel Hill. For every degree conferred, UNC Chapel Hill spends nearly double what NC State University does in terms of education and related expenses. In addition, NC State has reduced its spending by $9,474 since the 2007-08 school year, a nearly 14% decrease. In that time, UNC Chapel Hill reduced its spending by 7%, or $8,388, according to a report generated by the UNC System General Administration. I think it does reflect the efficiency measures we've put into place, says Chancellor Randy Woodson of NCSU. He points specifically to a focus by the university on encouraging students to graduate on time. Costs per degree go down when people spend less time at the university, Woodson says. He adds he typically does not compare NCSU with UNCH, largely because they offer different programs. In teasing out education and related spending, the UNC System's finance office includes expenses for instruction and student services, as well as portions of academic and institutional support, along with some costs for facility operations and maintenance. It does not include expenses for research, public service, hospital service, dining, depreciation, scholarships, and fellowships, or other auxiliary enterprises, explains Jonathan Pruitt, UNC System Senior Associate Vice President for Finance. Asked about UNCCH's cost, a spokesman said that there was no one at the university available to talk specifically about the numbers, but pointed out that the university offers degree programs through 14 schools and the College of Arts and Sciences. Chapel Hill offers 77 bachelor's, 109 master's, and 66 doctorate and 6 professional degree programs, says Mike McFarland. He's the director of university communications. NC State offers more than 110 bachelor's, more than 110 master's, 61 doctoral, and 1 doctorate of veterinary medicine. Chapel Hill has 24,222 full-time students, and NC State has 27,438. As for total degrees conferred in the past 5 years, NC State leads the way. In the 2011-12 school year, the Raleigh University produced 8,347 degrees, a 27% increase from 2007-08. In that same time, UNC Chapel Hill increased its degrees produced by 6.4% to 7,630 in 2011-12. NC State surpassed Chapel Hill in degrees conferred in the 2010-11 school year. All campuses combined, the UNC system has reduced spending per degree by 12%, even as it increased degrees conferred by 17.5%. The biggest declines in spending came in 2009-10 and 2011-12 school years, when major cuts were handed down by the state. North Carolina taxpayers contributed about $2.5 billion to the university system in each of the past 2 years, of which $310 million went to academic affairs for Chapel Hill and $435 million went to academic affairs for NC State. In 2009, the state appropriated $2.7 billion for the UNC system. In looking at the cuts handed down since then, Woodson says, "We are dangerously close to affecting the educational quality." He added that he wasn't saying that as a chancellor lobbying for more money, but as an administrator looking at the books. And now this week's lead article on the front page, the cost of sports. Across the nation, as in the Triangle, spending on student athletes outpaces other student spending. This article is by Jason DeBrune, and it's from Raleigh. Even as public universities in North Carolina and across the nation are dealing with massive cuts to their budgets, trends from the past decade show that spending per athlete has gone up in only one direction, and that is up. In fact, from 2005 to 2010, the median expenditure per athlete across football bowl subdivision programs increased by 51% to $91,936 per student athlete. During the same time, academic spending per full-time equivalent student increased by 23% to $13,628. Figures were compiled by the Delta Cost Project, an arm of the American Institutes for Research in Washington, D.C., which believes that college costs can be contained without sacrificing access or educational quality through better use of data to inform strategic decision-making. Donna DeRochers, a principal researcher at AIR, compiled the report using numbers provided by the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics and looked only at public universities. Cadence Otto teaches sports management at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee and reviewed the report. Like many who follow athletics in higher education, she says she was aware of the trends and that it calls into question the values of higher education. She says she finds it particularly troubling that many of her students do not realize the subsidy they pay to fund athletic departments. At $688 per student per year, WCU has the highest athletic student fee in the University of North Carolina system this year. Student athletic fees at NC State University and UNC Chapel Hill are $227 and $274.50, respectively. As the only two UNC system universities to play at the highest level of NCAA competition, they generate larger portions of their budgets internally through ticket sales, advertising, broadcast contracts, and the like. Their budgets are also much larger. NC State's athletics budget this year was nearly $60 million, of which nearly $12 million was budgeted to come from football ticket revenue. The average student athletics fee for the other 13 universities in the UNC system was nearly $600 this year. As for how the numbers were determined, data on spending for athletics is drawn from all intercollegiate athletic programs, not intramural or club sports. Specific items, for example, include compensation for coaches and staff, game expenses, recruiting costs, and student scholarships. Revenue includes what's generated by the programs and those allocated by the institution. Academic spending estimates come from a special tabulation of a Delta Cost Project database, which derives spending from mandatory reports filed by the universities with the U.S. Department of Education. Academic spending includes only direct and indirect costs related to educating students. DeRochers acknowledges that overall budgets for universities are much larger than for the athletics department, but when analyzed on a per-student basis, the median spending on athletics outpaces academic spending on students by nearly 7 times in the ACC. That ratio matches the FBS average and ranks 4th when compared to other major conferences. College athletics certainly provide non-financial benefits that are important to institutions such as campus spirit, name recognition, and reputation. But other campus benefits appear modest, with boosts in applications, enrollments, or fundraising, often a short-lived bonus resulting from a championship season. DeRochers writes in her report, despite large budgets, those in the top echelon of spending in the FBS may indeed impart less of a financial burden on their own institutions, but the vast majority of Division I, the top level, colleges and universities rely heavily on institutional support as they try to keep up. Everyone likes a winning team, but what is the cost? The College Sports Research Institute at UNC Chapel Hill analyzes various trends in college sports. Its director, Richard Southall, lists various aspects of university athletics that apply to spending. For one, it's a false economy, he says. Players are not paid in the same way professional athletes are, so labor costs are tightly controlled. Additionally, college coaches point to salaries being paid to professional coaches to draw comparisons. Finally, he says that even while state legislatures cut funding to universities, the university boards of trustees, many of whom seem to think of themselves as college sports owners akin to NFL or NBA owners, Southall says, don't seem to want to rein in spending on athletics. Continuing inside the front cover, construction remains in virtual recession. By Lee Weisbecker. This article is from Raleigh. With local and statewide construction industry payrolls still 30% below recent peak years, economists and industry observers are struggling to forecast a turnaround. In fact, despite some signs to the contrary, most say a full-fledged recovery may not begin before 2014. I wish I had some optimistic numbers, said Robert Crum, founder of Durham-based North Carolina Construction News. Unemployment in the industry as a whole remains about 13.5%, says Crum. In the Triangle, 2012 ended with building trades employment, a key measure of the industry, at around 36,300, nearly 29% down from the region's 2007 peak. 6 years ago, when housing starts were reaching 3,700 a quarter, more than twice the current rate, the Triangle's construction roster hit a peak of 51,000. Statewide, at the close of 2012, construction payrolls had fallen to 173,800, down by 30% from a 2008 peak. The numbers include across-the-board construction jobs, including commercial and other non-residential, plus residential. Most experts agree that it will be housing that paces an eventual turnaround. Housing is improving and is finally poised for a rebound, says North Carolina General Assembly economist Barry Boardman in a January 2013 forecast. Steady population growth and the estimated excess demand for North Carolina housing suggest that housing construction may be set to take off in 2014. Some construction industry growth is expected this year, with UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton putting the anticipated statewide growth rate at 1.9%. A recent survey of North Carolina construction companies by Arlington, Virginia-based Associated General Contractors of America, AGC, an industry trade group, also suggests modest growth over the next 12 months. According to AGC, some 30% of North Carolina companies expect to hire workers in 2013, with a majority of those saying the additions will be of five or fewer employees. 2. Meanwhile, only 8% of firms said they expect to have layoffs in 2013. 3. When asked when they expect to see resumed growth in the industry, only 20% picked 2013 as the turnaround year. And 4. 30% picked 2014, while 35% picked 2016. AGC's Brian Turmel says 60 companies that say they do the bulk of their work in North Carolina responded to the survey questions. That was the third highest respondent number for the 30 states included in the report. At best, the AGC results express only cautious optimism for a turnaround in the near future. Crum, on the other hand, who primarily follows non-residential construction, points to another indicator and does discover a few positive indications. It's the Architecture Billing Index, ABI, produced at the AIA Economics and Market Research Group. A leading indicator, it's thought to provide a 9 to 12 month glimpse into the future of non-residential construction spending activity. As of December 27th, says Crum, it was standing at 53.2, the strongest index rating since late 2007. He says, at present, design firms in the Northeast and Midwest are reporting a reasonably sharp upturn in business conditions. Firms in the South are reporting a modest increase, and firms in the West, a very modest decline. Next up, taxing services most likely to gain approval. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The fallback position on reforming the state tax code is placing a sales tax on more services. And with more dramatic and comprehensive reform proposals, total elimination of individual income and corporate taxes, for example, now hitting brick walls, talk about the fallback is expected to increase. Right now, North Carolina puts its 4.75% sales tax levy on roughly 12 service areas, including cable TV, tuxedo rentals and diaper services, electricity, heating oil, photocopying, and the like, according to General Assembly fiscal researcher Cindy Averett. Among the states, 31 tax more services. Among the states, 31 tax more services than North Carolina, according to a 2007 survey, the latest available. By taxing more of them, according to the argument, the door would be open for a tax-based expansion that, in turn, would permit lawmakers to cut individual income and corporate tax rates. And reducing both the corporate rate drastically continues to be the goal of House Speaker Tom Tillis, who outlined his agenda this week without going into many specifics. Quote, I think there are good ideas out there, says Tillis, end quote, who agrees that hitting on some formula for expanding the state tax base would have to be part of the change. Accomplishing that expansion by taxing more services, from haircuts to oil changes and beyond, have been given a thumbs up by numerous tax study commissions over the past decade. It's the sound compromise position, says Brent Lane of the UNC Chapel Hill Center for Competitive Economics. It also fits with the other major changes that have taken place in the state over the past decades. Back in 1979, when North Carolinians spent a dollar, 47 cents of it went to buy some sort of service, as opposed to goods, durable or otherwise. Today, nearly 60 cents of every consumption dollar is spent on a service. Robbie Sawyers, a North Carolina State University professor and sales tax expert, says taxing more services would be a fairly straightforward proposition for the state, but there would be difficulties. The question is whether you would also want to tax business-to-business services as opposed to just the retail. That's an area where this can become complex, he explains. Besides sales tax extensions, other reform ideas are currently making the rounds on Jones Street. Among them are a couple of proposals put forward by Mecklenburg County Senator Bob Rucho. The first is a 1% real estate conveyance tax, a levy that put on deeds exchanging hands. The second is a 1% annual business license fee assessed against the capital stock of C-Corps and against the owner's equity of LLCs and sole proprietorships. Tillis, for one, has expressed reservations about the transfer tax, saying he believes it would retard job creation in real estate. And now an article by Amanda Jones Hoyle about cars. She says the car sales are revving up. And this article is from Raleigh. For car buyers seeking auto loans and for dealers seeking buyers, happy days are here again. Sales of new cars and trucks at dealerships across North Carolina were up about 14% in 2012 over 2011, a rate that was slightly higher than the national average of 13% growth for the year. In the Triangle, new vehicle registrations for new autos were up even higher, with nearly 18% more cars and trucks sold in 2012 compared to the year before. According to a report from the North Carolina Automobile Dealers Association. December was the best month in our company's history, says Tom Blocker, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Hendrick Automotive Group in Charlotte, which owns and operates 11 dealership locations in the Triangle. While foreign imports still find favor with many buyers, America's rejuvenated car makers are roaring back to profitability after two of them, General Motors and Chrysler, were helped by federal loans. One-time money loser Ford Motor Company, which declined any government aid on January 29th, reported a pre-tax quarterly profit of $1.7 billion. Blocker says more banks and investor groups are getting back into the business of lending money to people to buy cars, and that is helping consumers shrug off economic worries that stifled auto sales during the previous 4 years. We're finding more banks want to come to the party, he says. Johnny Dudley, operations manager for Chris Leith Automotive in Wake Forest, says the outlook for auto sales in 2013 is as strong as it was in 2012. The ball to keep your eye on is what lenders are going to do, he says. I think they figured out how to lend for cars again, and it's kind of nice to see that coming back. While the NCADA data does not break down auto sales by model, it offers categories, and the sale of imported cars rose by 21% year over year. Leading the pack was Toyota and Honda, two automakers that had trouble producing in 2011 following natural disasters in Asia, and the German-made Volkswagen. Each grew their unit sales in the state by at least 25%. Toyota also recaptured the title of the world's largest automaker in 2012, which reported global sales of 9.75 million compared to GM's global sales of 9.29 million in 2012. Blocker says Hendrick's Toyota dealership in Apex that opened in mid-2011 sold 3,000 new Toyotas during the year. That was the number we were kind of hoping for, but not really expecting, he says. It was a phenomenal year. Even the European-made Fisker Karma, which starts at $102,000 for the basic model, made its debut in the state with 10 sales recorded in 2012. Industry-wide, it could still be another couple of years before U.S. auto sales top 16 million units again, which is what the industry was averaging each year from the late 1990s through 2007. In 2012, U.S. auto buyers purchased 14.5 million cars and trucks from both domestic and import automakers. The industry hit bottom in 2009 when sales were only 10.4 million units. That was also the year that GM and Chrysler declared bankruptcy, requiring the federal help. Now, all of the downsized domestic car companies are profitable. Next up, with launch, Chapel Hill is weighing in on innovation. By Lauren K. Onisorge from Chapel Hill. Some movers and shakers in Chapel Hill are on a mission to get the town the credit they think it deserves for innovation. A project called Launch Chapel Hill, set to officially kick off in March, could attach the term entrepreneurship to the city permanently. That's the hope of the four entities teaming up for the endeavor. The town of Chapel Hill, the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership, Orange County, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Nothing like this has ever been done before, notes Ted Zoller, director for the Center for Entrepreneurship Studies at UNC. At least not in Chapel Hill. But why doesn't Chapel Hill already get innovation credit? Innovation indisputably happens, an example being UNC spinoff Liquidia, which won a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation grant and a big deal with GlaxoSmithKline. While Chapel Hill has stiff nearby competition in Raleigh, Durham, and Research Triangle Park, the Orange County town has innovation moxie in its midst. The Center for Entrepreneurial Studies contributes to the UNC Kenan Flagler Business School, being ranked number 8 for entrepreneurship, according to Bloomberg Businessweek. So why is it perceived as lagging behind other triangle clusters in terms of reputation for innovation? Bobby Funk, assistant director for the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership, says part of the reason is cost, and Chapel Hill's generally more expensive when it comes to office space. When it comes to office space, Chapel Hill comes up short in several regards, says Lee Storer, a member of the Chapel Hill Town Council. If you look at Durham or even the park, just the amount of space they have looks different than Chapel Hill, he explains. Durham has beautiful historic tobacco warehouses downtown, and Research Triangle Park has much more physical room to grow. That's a limitation we've had before in Chapel Hill. Rex Thomas of commercial real estate firm Evison Young says a big factor in the cost of space in Chapel Hill is due to much of it being relatively new. The price sounds higher because a lot of the space has been built in the last 5 years. Price can be determined by the age of the development. The newer the building, the more expensive its lease price, he says. And that's where Launch Chapel Hill can come in, Funk says. We're trying to help provide exciting, innovative space at a price point where startups can afford it and hopefully find a way to keep themselves attracted in being at this location, he says. The initiative, located in the Three Birds marketing space on Rosemary Street, has garnished support across the board, including unanimous approval by town council, which Storrow says is a feat in itself. We'll be signaling to the rest of the triangle that we're here and that we want new and innovative business folks to come foster that development, he says. Zoller refers to the space as a mentor lab. Unlike incubators that are typically a long-term rental situation, entrepreneurs will be limited to 6 months in the space, with the option of a 6-month renewal, and researchers will observe and participate in the process. We've never had a place where we could actually work in a laboratory setting with these companies, Zoller says. This gives us an opportunity to really learn and to share what we know. Zoller's team is working with the folks at Durham-based startup Space American Underground to provide a comprehensive resource to its soon-to-be inhabitants. About 15 entrepreneurial projects will be housed in Launch Chapel Hill. 10 offices and 15 desk spaces are just part of the perks. The teams will net mentors and fundraising assistants. There will be a lot of diversity in terms of innovation, in terms of different approaches towards business, he says, adding that most of the applicants so far have been UNC Chapel Hill students. Funding was spearheaded by a big-name private donor, Zoller says, adding that the donor will make his or her name public in March. Our private donor is a game-changer, he says, offering no further hints. The town is contributing about $30,000 a year on top of the county's $40,000 a year. The initial commitment is 3.5 years. The launch of Launch happens March 9th, and applications for companies will be accepted through January 28th. Next up, Listen Up, Raleigh Company Making Vibes with Headphones, by Lauren K. Onisores, from Raleigh. What do Nicole Snooky Polizzi, Tim Tebow, and Stephen LaBeouf have in common? Buzzworthy headphones, of course. Snooky is the star of TV's Jersey Shore. Tebow is a pro football quarterback few seem to respect. LaBeouf, he's the CEO of Raleigh-based Valencel, and he, along with the more well-known Snooky and Tebow, showcased their custom headphones at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January. The standout? LaBeouf, and here's why. His headphones, dubbed the iRiver On, don't have flashy branding or pink feather decor. They stood out because of a technology developed here called PerformTech, which involves sensors that give the wearer fitness biometric information such as heart rate, burned calories, all while playing music, books, or whatever is chosen. A partnership with Korean firm iRiver means that Valencel's technology will hit the shelves in March and headphones retailing for about $199. LaBeouf says it's the first of 4 Valencel products to hit the market this year. You'll hear some big news from us at the end of the first quarter, he says, and he's cryptic. Be looking for a project this year that is not a headphone, that can have our technology inside, that can be worn at other parts of the body. He does say to expect wrist devices and arm devices, and that the technology is going to be applied for use in fitness training and coaching. My dreams are always so much wilder than any man can hope for, he says. No matter how good things go, I'm always looking for what's beyond. And he says that things are good, specifically to visitors who come to the company's booth at the CES, and he says they responded well to his product. They're so good that the 17-employee operation, which has raised more than $6.5 million in venture financing, plans to double in size this year. But LaBeouf insists Valencel's story isn't just about the Raleigh company. It's about the partnering companies whose models will be transformed with the technology. Take the iRiver partnership, he says. Henry Park, the CEO of iRiver, had a mission to change that company around, he says, explaining that iRiver used to be a leader in the MP3 market before being trounced by Apple. That's when it needed a new strategy. Henry took the reins and tried to differentiate the company, high-performance audio and fitness products. Valencel investor Best Buy Capital arranged for the two company leaders to meet. It was a great fit for Henry because he was hungry for tech, and we were hungry for a partner like him, LaBeouf explains, adding that iRiver's new direction will redefine the company. There's been great demand, so we're thrilled to be the first to market, Park says in a statement regarding the PerformTech technology. LaBeouf won't be specific regarding royalty and licensing arrangements for the iRiver deal. He also won't be specific regarding how many partners he signed on to the technology, though he repeatedly says multiple partnerships will result in 4 products in 2013, including the headphones. The sectors are different, he says, adding that along with mobile headset manufacturing brands, Audio accessory brands, iRiver, and sports and fitness brands are among current partnerships. He's also looking at scaling into other sectors, such as healthcare. Since the headphones haven't hit the market, it's hard to judge their marketability. But the Raleigh Lab is seeing positive results from testers, says exercise physiologist Chris Eisenbach. They exercise with it, he notes. They say they don't even feel like it's on their neck. And now an article from the Banking and Finance section of the Triangle Business Journal. Fees paid by pension funds soar by 28%. This article is by Lee Weisbecker and it's from Raleigh. Fees paid by the North Carolina pension system to outside money managers during the 12 months that ended in June amounted to $318 million, a 28% increase over the prior year. Other costs associated with the state's effort to invest in $74.5 billion in pension cash hit $61 million during the same 12 months, up $5 million from the prior year. Those costs include the system's own investment staffing expenses of $4.7 million, $27 million paid in taxes on foreign stock dividends, and $35 million paid out in a broad category dubbed Other. The numbers that were included in a report by North Carolina Treasurer Janet Cowell to the state's Joint Legislative Commission on Governmental Operations, known as GovOps, in late December. Detailed fee payments to more than 200 outside managers were not included in the GovOps report. In 2011, the fund paid $248 million to outside managers. Nationwide, during that same year, the 50 U.S. public pension systems, which have combined assets of more than $2 trillion, paid out fees totaling $7.8 billion. The average ratio of fees to assets nationwide was 0.409%. North Carolina's ratio that year was 0.452%, slightly higher than the national average, according to Maryland-based researcher Jeff Hoke. Similar Wall Street fee ratios using 2012 pension system fee information have not been crunched, but under North Carolina's stated policy of putting more of its stock holdings into hedge fund operations, management fees are likely to continue to move higher. Asked for comment on that matter, Treasurer spokeswoman Julia Vail did not respond. Some investment experts, including Raleigh's Ron Elmer, have questioned the wisdom of sinking cash into hedge and other higher fee operations. Instead, says Elmer, the system could get equal, if not better, returns by putting its money into lower-cost, passively managed stock index funds and, or by doing more management internally. It's got to be said that they aren't doing anything different than a lot of other state pension funds are doing. You just have to question it, says Elmer, a CPA and investment book author who ran unsuccessfully against Cowell in the Democratic Party primary for treasurer last year. The North Carolina Pension Fund completed fiscal 2012 ended June 30th with an overall return of 2.21%. That was better than the 1.15% return posted for the same period by the Wilshire Index, a measure of roughly 900 foundations, endowments, and union retirement funds, corporate plans, and public pensions. The North Carolina system rebounded somewhat after June of last year, posting 4.46% return for the 3 months ending September 30th. Wilshire advanced by 4.67% in the same period. This article is on the spotlight of the business of sports. It's titled, TV and NHL Help Boost the Canes' Top Line. It's written by Jason DeBrun, and it's from Raleigh. The Carolina Hurricanes generated more revenue during the 2011-12 season, $84.6 million, than during any year since 2009, a year it advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals of the National Hockey League. The increased revenue came largely from a boost in television revenue and revenue from the NHL. In fact, ticket revenue was below the previous year and suite sales stayed flat for the third year. There's nothing here that is inconsistent or what we are concerned about, says General Manager Jim Rutherford. We do need to work on growing our revenue, and we have a new television deal starting next season that generates considerably more revenue. The Hurricanes renegotiated a television contract with FS Carolinas that will take effect with the 2013-14 season. As part of the deal, FS Carolinas will show all 82 Canes games. Financial specifics of that deal were not released. During the offseason in 2012, Hurricanes majority owner Pete Karmanos brought in a group of minority investors, including retired Hurricanes great Ron Francis, now a team executive, who kicked in a combined $20 million. It's possible the added revenue helped prompt the usually conservative Karmanos into a spending spree this past offseason. The team added Jordan Stahl and gave him and fan favorite Jeff Skinner long-term contracts. Stahl received a 10-year, $60 million contract, and Skinner inked a 6-year deal at $34 million. The Canes also signed blockbuster free agent Alexander Semin to a 1-year deal this year. I think the numbers are an indication of the excellent job that Pete Karmanos and Jim Rutherford have done since arriving in the area and building an incredibly loyal fan base in a non-traditional hockey market, says Tom McCormick, board chairman of the Centennial Authority. It's a body of appointees who serve as the landlord for PNC Arena. Local people really appreciate not only the hockey, but just as importantly, the community outreach and participation by the organization. With the shortened season, revenue will be down this year, but of course, so will expenses. Hopefully, though, the Canes will make a deep playoff run and recoup some of the lost revenue, says McCormick, who is also the Raleigh City Attorney. During the offseason, the Centennial Authority spent about $1 million on various PNC Arena improvements. This week's small business profile is Blue Sky Services. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle. It's from Raleigh. A twist of fate kept Blue Sky Services owner David Metvitz did not move to Arizona in 1996 to open a health club and start a water filtration business as he had planned to do with an old friend. "I was all ready to move to Tempe, Arizona, when Hurricane Fran hit," Medvitz remembers. The hurricane-packed winds that were still gusting to 78 miles an hour when it reached Raleigh in September 1996, bringing down trees and damaging structures in Medvitz's neighborhood behind Millbrook High School in North Raleigh. "I couldn't leave because I had to fix my house," he says. Medvitz, who's known as a multitasker, says he tried to hire a contractor to repair the house, but after several weeks of waiting for workers to arrive, he decided to fix the damage himself. "I thought, I can do this," knowing that the insurance company was going to give me the same check regardless, he says. "I found out there were big margin spreads when it came to pricing construction work." After finishing the work on his home, Medvitz started working on his neighbor's homes, which kept him busy for about a year. In 1997, he incorporated Blue Sky Services Incorporated of Raleigh, specializing in home renovation and remodeling projects across the region and later across the state. Room additions, remodeling, and renovation projects of up to $500,000 remain the bread-and-butter business for Blue Sky Services, even though Medvitz has since branched into other services for the real estate and construction markets. In 2002, he started the Building Blocks Publications Company to help local home improvement contracting companies and vendors market their businesses to consumers. Building Blocks now manages the websites of about 60 companies. In 2009, Medvitz formed a partnership with Raleigh real estate broker Keith Said to start Blue Sky Services Real Estate to help property owners market and sell commercial buildings and vacant land around the Triangle. In 2012, he started Blue Sky Services Equity Advisors to work with commercial property owners in the region seeking to appeal property taxes owed to the county. "In North Carolina, you don't have to have an attorney to appeal your taxes," Medvitz says. "You can appeal them on your own, so this was an easy fit with us since we already know residential and commercial markets." In late 2012, Medvitz took his biggest step yet out of his comfort zone and formed a partnership with Raleigh native and Wilmington commercial building veteran Steve Niemeyer to expand Blue Sky Services into the commercial construction market. Their plan, Niemeyer says, is to begin bidding on bigger building projects for the Triangle to the coast. We've already bid on several jobs, he says, and a $50 million project won't scare us. Medvitt's combined companies brought in about $6.5 million in revenue in both 2011 and 2012, he says. And he expects the company to crush those numbers in 2013 with the addition of the commercial building projects and other plans still in the works. To me, it's all new and exciting again, he says. I'm just like a kid with a brand new toy. This week's guest column is by Rick Kelly. Mr. Kelly is a vice president with CSC that serves as North Carolina's replacement Medicaid Management Information System contractor. This article is entitled Enabling Healthcare Delivery. North Carolina is on the verge of a milestone in both healthcare and technology. An update of its massive electronic filing system for handling claims submitted on behalf of the state's approximately 1.7 million recipients covered by the NC Department of Health and Human Services, also known as DHHS. The work is ongoing. It's accomplished in its teams in DHHS and CSC, the company hired by the state in 2009. Collaborative meetings and of various types of breakthroughs occur every day with one goal in mind: developing an efficient solution for the state's approximately 70,000 DHHS providers and their patients. Called NCTRACS, the new system will reduce paperwork and allow providers to more easily determine recipient eligibility, submit claims, and check on the status of claims payments. If a claim has hit a snag for some reason, the provider can find that out with a few keystrokes and rectify the situation. This frees up healthcare providers to focus less on administration and more on health. The new system will also be multi-payer, meaning it will expand the claims processing and payment functionality to include Division of Public Health, the Migrant Health Program in the Office of Rural Health and Community Care, the Division of Medical Assistance and the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities and Substance Abuse Services. Providers will be able to get more done administratively in one place, which saves time and effort. These are all important features, and we are in the process now of sharing them with our broader team, including North Carolina's wide spectrum of providers. Activities currently underway include 1. In August, the state began User Acceptance Testing, UAT, to validate that the business and system requirements coded by CSC are operating accurately and appropriately. 2. In September, organizations such as the North Carolina Chapter of the Healthcare Financial Management Association and the North Carolina Association of Long-Term Care Facilities received an overview of certain capabilities related to NCTRACS. And 3. In November through mid-January, a representative sample of providers began participating in an early look at the NCTRACS system during the state's UAT activities. All of this sharing activity is part of a larger rollout plan, which will include extensive provider training before the new system goes into general use in July 2013. Together, we are helping to hone a system that aimed at enabling North Carolina's approximately 70,000 providers to deliver more efficient and even higher quality health care. This week's editor notebook is from Sugata Murakeji, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. It's entitled, With Enterprise Line, Lenovo Offers Promise. When IBM Corporation sold off its personal computer business to Lenovo back in 2007, there were plenty of critics who suggested IBM got rid of a dying business and found a sucker in Lenovo to pick up the business for $1.7 billion. Boy, were those critics wrong. For one, the purchase itself gave Lenovo a worldwide brand that spread awareness of this Chinese player, which until then was an unknown in the United States. Having proven its point that this Chinese giant can hang with the big boys such as Hewlett-Packard and Dell in the personal computer business, Lenovo is now embarking on the next stage of expansion. And it starts with the splitting of the company into two parts. Lenovo Business Group, the consumer electronics division that caters to the low-end markets, and Think Business Group, the commercial arm of the computer company that focuses on the high-end market. With Morrisville anchored as the company's U.S. base, there is a lot at stake for the Triangle. For me, it is clear the folks in China want to control the electronics part of the business that has to do with the consumer. The company wants to go head-to-head against the likes of Apple, Google, and Samsung Electronics, so it will need a lot of development work or perhaps a couple of key acquisitions to get started. See the pattern? How did Lenovo get into the U.S. personal computer business? So that part of the business is going to be driven by the Chinese. At least that's what I think. But the commercial business, which is a whole different ball of wax, probably will be run from the United States. That's where the customers are, and so are the high margins. And that's good for Morrisville business, because more likely, with the hiring of Jerry Smith, who also happens to be the first American to be on Lenovo's executive committee, the big decisions can be made from the Triangle. There is a downside, however. If Lenovo is successful in its strategy of becoming a household electronics name, is it possible the company would consider spinning off the Think business unit? In fact, why not take it public? And that can be fantastic news for the Triangle as long as the CEO of the Think unit is based in Morrisville and the company's vision and execution is driven by folks in the United States. More than 50 years ago, there was one company in the Triangle that transformed the area and made a believer out of the North Carolina visionaries, IBM Corporation, with its RTP presence. We can go through the same transformation once again to lift our area. Think of what Round Rock, Texas-based Dell has done for Austin. Now, if Lenovo Chairman Yang Yuquan decides to keep both units under the Chinese umbrella, he has to deal with supply chain issues. For consumer products, the cycle is vastly different for commercial products. A lot can go wrong if the company embarks on using a single-flow business system to manage two large business units. Lenovo has become a power player, arguably the best Chinese global brand. Okay, maybe after Lin Na, who may have attracted more fans after her defeat at the Austrian Open tennis finals than anyone in the women's tennis world last week. The Triangle has lost a few well-known companies in the past couple of years. Progress Energy and RBC Bank come to mind, and I'm sure there are a few more. If there's one company that needs North Carolina's full attention right now, it's Lenovo. I hope we bring everyone to the table and the company sees the value of including the Triangle as part of the transformation in further strengthening its global position. You know, the Pinehurst Airport is getting spiffed up for the U.S. Golf, and folks in Moore County are busy getting ready to host both the men's and the women's U.S. Open golf tournaments in 2014. And that includes extending the runways at Moore County Airport and converting the passenger waiting area into an executive lounge for all those bigwigs who will be flying in on their corporate jets. But there's more on the plate of those who run the little airport, led by Executive Director Steve Borden. He and others are working to convince a regional carrier to launch service at the field. "We got a lot on the plate," Borden says, and he tells this to the Pilot newspaper in Southern Pines. All this stuff is being done for the 2014 U.S. Opens and to make the airport safer and more comfortable for our customers. Airport officials say they're getting some interest from carriers to start service, which has been missing since 2007 when Delta Airlines pulled out. But they say they have no interest in subsidizing flights, as is now being done at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Meanwhile, students at Duke University are all up in arms, and it's not about their cherished Blue Devils losing to the NC State Wolfpack. Seems a West Campus eatery called the Armadillo Grill is about to be replaced by another eatery called Loop Pizza Grill. Hundreds have signed a petition to keep the Dillo open. "I'm heartbroken," sophomore Georgia Swee told the Duke Chronicle regarding the Armadillo Grill. "I just recently discovered their amazing tacos." The closing is due to renovations underway at the Bryan Center and West Union. Also afoot is a move to rid campus of fast food restaurants in exchange for what are deemed healthier options. Like Loop Pizza? Plans to convert the old Dix Hospital property in Raleigh into a city park have gotten a financial shot in the arm. Gregory Pool Equipment Company in Raleigh is kicking in $250,000. Company Chairman and CEO Gregory Pool III, son of Dix Visionaries leader Gregory Pool Jr., says it's important for the business community to make Dix Park a true public-private partnership. On behalf of our 850 employees, it pleases me to make this contribution, knowing North Carolina will someday soon have its own Central Park and will further enhance our legacy of being a progressive visionary state. The Dix Visionaries and other support groups for Dix Park have a goal of raising $3 million to pay for a master plan for the land's conversion. The Raleigh City Council approved a $500,000 a year lease deal with the state in December to take over management and future development of the 325-acre Dix property. Congratulations to the Hillsboro Barbecue Company in Hillsboro. Open only for little more than a year, the eatery has been named the town's Business of the Year for helping revitalize a section of the Orange County community. The restaurant cooks up pig on a pit in the back and quickly has become a gathering spot for residents and visitors to the town. The wood comes from Kate's Sawmill in Orange County, and Biz is going to have to slide right on over and check out that pig. Just so you know, leafy greens are dangerous. Really, just ask the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The agency just released a report that says greens such as lettuce, spinach, and kale accounted for the most foodborne illnesses nationwide from 1998 to 2008. Dairy products were number one for hospitalizations, and the most deaths were linked to poultry. But don't worry, says Dr. Patricia Griffin, a foodborne disease expert at the CDC. She tells USA Today in the study wasn't meant to be a risk of illness per serving list for the consumers. And Durham-based Quintiles Cancer website has been recognized with its third Web Health Award. The site, clinicalresearch.com, is aimed at patients looking for clinical trials, and the award went to the microsite dealing with oncology. The Web Health Awards were founded 14 years ago by the Health Information Resource Center to recognize digital health resources. The HIRC is based in Libertyville, Illinois. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.